Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We do have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, but we start with the news, Jim, that doesn't really fit a martini. It is news that is rocking the conservative world. It's rocking Washington. It's rocking one family in particular, and that's the news that actually happened Saturday. Most of us found out about it Sunday, and that's that Jake Brewer was killed. Jake Brewer was a senior advisor in the White House Technology Office, and he's probably best known to conservatives as the husband of very successful commentator and writer and author Mary Catherine Hamm. They were married for about 4 years. They have a 2-year-old daughter. They have another one on the way here in a couple of months. He was taking part in a charity bike ride to raise money for cancer. And he had an accident. He was struck by a car and lost. And obviously, it just shocks everyone who knew them. I did not know them personally, but just knowing of them, and certainly of Mary Catherine, it stopped me in my tracks yesterday. And I'm sure many other people, I know you know her, have met him. And it's good to see the community rallying and even a fund set up for their kids' education. But it just completely takes your breath away.
It does. And it puts a lot of what we deal with in the realm of politics on a day-to-day basis into perspective. Most of what we talk about doesn't really matter that much. It's not going to be remembered. It doesn't really touch people's lives. I only got a chance to meet Jake Brewer once or twice. I know Mary Catherine Hamm much better. And as you kind of alluded to in the introduction, he worked in the Obama White House. He was a left-of-center guy. She very clearly is a right-of-center gal. They came together and had a, you know, made a beautiful family. It's kind of one of those happy little success stories of love conquering all. And it's exceptionally sad and surprising and devastating to see come out of the blue like this. Awful news like this. I think all of us are kind of walking around just stunned, wondering how something like this could happen, that people like this aren't just supposed to suddenly not be in your lives one day. Obviously, everyone's offering thoughts and prayers. As you said, there's been a GoFundMe kind of fundraising online set up for their daughter and their other child's educations. As of this moment, they're about $148,000. They're aiming to raise $200,000, and it looks like they're a good chance of hitting that. So thanks to their friend Guy Benson for putting that together and the generosity of all these people who want to help a family at a time like this. We all feel kind of helpless to do something about this, and this is one way to kind of give them one less thing to worry about in the weeks, months, and years to come. So in the light of all that, here are three things that don't matter nearly as much, Greg.
Please keep Mary Catherine and her entire family in your prayers. They need that more than anything right now. On to the good martini, and we actually go back to Friday and two different votes in the House of Representatives. Jim, it was just a couple of weeks ago we were chiding Mitch McConnell for saying, you know, gosh darn it, we really hate to keep funding Planned Parenthood, but as long as we have this president, we can't do anything about it, so we're really not going to have any votes on this until hopefully we get a president in a couple of years who has a very different view on Planned Parenthood. After blowback, I don't know, from the grassroots, from conservative members, it looks like there are at least going to be votes on this in the Senate. There were, on Friday, two of them. One was to defund Planned Parenthood. That passed 241 to 187. And it looks like Senate Republicans have already found a way to make it so that they don't need to hit the 60-vote threshold to move that to the president's desk. He has also promised a veto on that. The other one is the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, and this was sponsored by Trent Franks of Arizona. It's in response to the video from the Center for Medical Progress that had the story of the technicians with a baby that survived an abortion, heart still beating, still kicking, cutting through the face to procure brain. This would now criminalize anyone in the medical profession who fails to use all reasonable medical procedures to save the life of a child that is outside the womb. There is already the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. This attaches criminal penalties to it. That passed the House 248 to 177. The president, amazingly enough, has promised to veto this legislation as well. But, Jim, it shows that Republicans are at least willing to fight a little bit on this. Hopefully it can get some momentum. Trent Franks thinks his bill can actually get past a filibuster. And if the president wants to hang his hat on defending the right to kill babies outside of the womb, you got to hope that the Republicans can win on that fight.
Yeah, and I just wanted to kind of one thing that kind of jumps out about this example. When you hear people expressing frustration with Republican leadership on Capitol Hill, they almost say, you know, Boehner and McConnell, McConnell and Boehner. Like, it's almost like it's one name that they kind of smoosh together. And while I think you've got, you know, that there are reasons for frustration with both of them, I kind of have this feeling that they're approaching their jobs differently, and they have different tasks. Ultimately, the House doesn't have a filibuster, right? So ultimately, if you got 218 votes, you can get it through there. And at least on this issue, and at least in this case, Boehner is getting something done. The real obstacle in for this particular one is McConnell and the Senate, and the, you know, his frustration of, well, we can't get it past. Obama's going to veto it anyway, so we're not even going to bring it to a vote, which I think is just flat out mistaken thinking. Then the next philosophy is, well, we can bring it to the vote, but we can't overcome the filibuster, which, you know, I and other crazed right-wingers like Charles Krauthammer have asked whether you really want to have a filibuster if you're going to, you know, have it interfere with your ability to just get stuff to the president's desk, even if you know it's going to end up being vetoed. So, you know, Boehner's doing himself some good here. McConnell still is facing a great deal of skepticism, and I think he's going to have to do a lot more to earn back the trust of the right. I just don't think this is a manageable situation in which how much, you know, in that you can't have the base of a party detesting the leadership and the leadership not doing anything to address that. So hopefully this is a step on that road to getting more Republicans all singing from the same songbook and, you know, pulling their oars in the same direction.
On to the bad martini now, and this one is probably as bad as we've ever had, Jim. And if anyone's got small kids in the car or in the room right now, you might want to hit pause until you have a chance to listen to this by yourself. This is from the New York Times by Joseph Goldstein. In his last phone call home, Lance Corporal Gregory Buckley Jr. told his father what was troubling him. From his bunk in southern Afghanistan, he could hear Afghan police officers sexually abusing boys they had brought to the base. Rampant sexual abuse of children has long been a problem in Afghanistan, particularly among armed commanders who dominate much of the rural landscape and can bully the population. The practice is called boy play, and American soldiers and Marines have been instructed not to intervene, in some cases not even when their Afghan allies have abused boys on military bases. Dan Quinn, a former Special Forces captain who beat up an American-backed militia commander for keeping a boy chained to his bed as a sex slave, was relieved from his command and pulled from Afghanistan. He has since left the military. Now the Army is trying to forcibly retire a guy named Sergeant First Class Charles Martland, a Green Beret who joined Captain Quinn in beating up that commander. A Pentagon official, Colonel Brian Tribus, spokesman for the American command in Afghanistan, when asked about this policy, wrote, "Generally, allegations of child sexual abuse by Afghan military or police personnel would be a matter of domestic Afghan criminal law," adding there is no express requirement that U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan report it. Jim, what are we even doing? Where is our moral authority in the world if this is still going on?
I don't care if this is a tradition over there. I don't care if this is commonplace over there. If denouncing that and demanding it stop makes me a cultural imperialist, then just call me a friggin' cultural imperialist. Like, if we can't stand up against that, then you're right. I don't understand why we've been there. The curious thing, since this, you know, the news broke this morning, I've seen quite a few folks on Twitter, you know, saying that, oh, this, we've known this for a really long time. I was over there. I saw this sort of thing. It was common. It disgusted me, but this was kind of just this, you know, woven into the fabric of Afghan daily life. And you look at that, you're thinking, "Wow! Like, how would this not be a huge, you know, it's, you know, doubly horrifying that this could, you know, go." There are three horrifying aspects of this: one, the act; two, the apparently official blind eye, and then the U.S. government, kind of the U.S. military, saying, "Look, we're not going to deal with this. This is not our problem. We're not here to change Afghan views on sex abuse." And then the third one is the idea that, yes, this was fairly common and, you know, seen often, and no one really felt much need to do anything about it up until this revelation. It's kind of shocking and horrifying. We've had some bad martinis, but I think this one ranks really high up there, Greg.
Yes. It's just a thoroughly depressing episode today, but we go on to the crazy martini now. And this is horrible news too, but considering everything else we've talked about, this is probably the least troubling news of the day, unless your name is Scott Walker. There's a new CNN opinion research poll out, taken entirely after last week's debate, and it shows favorability ratings for all the different candidates as well as where they stand in the recent polls. And a lot of folks are talking about how Trump has lost a few points, Fiorina and Rubio are doing a little bit better than they had been prior to the debate. But the real story here, Jim, and we've seen this in polls even leading up to the debate, is the utter collapse of Scott Walker, who just a few weeks ago was one of the top figures nationwide for the nomination and certainly in the first caucus state of Iowa. In this poll, he gets an asterisk, which means he has less than half a percentage point, according to Republican voters nationwide. And when asked who folks' second choice was, he only got 2%. Talk about an absolute implosion.
Yeah. No, I just posted up on the corner that this is, you know, this is indisputably bad news. It's not quite as bad as it may initially seem. For starters, he didn't get a zero in all respondents, just a zero in the percentage points. And that's really setting the bar very low. A bit more useful is that the margin of error for that poll is 4.5%. It's a little bigger than you'd like to see on a poll like this. And let's face it, Scott Walker had been in the mid to low single digits before this. So it's not unbelievably stunning to see him in this kind of a setup of being very low. He's apparently retooling his campaign. He's going to focus more on Iowa, for better or for worse. When you get 8 minutes in a three-hour debate, it doesn't surprise me that much that you just kind of, people kind of forget about you. And it's unfair and it's not right. And I think he's got to fight his way to the microphone and be more of the central to the debate again. On the flip side, maybe some of this is an issue of CNN making the decision to have 11 different candidates up on stage at one time. You know, that a guy like, you know, Scott Walker is not necessarily going to dominate a stage with the likes of Chris Christie and Donald Trump. Now, can he turn around? I guess we're all going to see. That's why they play the games. But for a guy who a lot of people had seen, is, you know, for one point was kind of considered the co-front runner with Jeb Bush and was seen as a, if nothing else, a top-tier serious guy and a guy who could kind of have one leg in the world of the Tea Party and one leg in the world of the establishment, a conservative reformer who had actually gotten stuff done. It's just not looking good for him right now at all, and it's just kind of baffling to see this kind of landslide-like collapse of his support so rapidly.
I think he probably got hurt also by various positions on certain issues. He had three different positions on immigration within about a 48-hour period at one point. He kind of went back and forth on Kim Davis and other issues as well along the way. So I think folks are more frustrated with inconsistency than even a consistent position they might disagree with, particularly if it's not an issue that they're particularly passionate about. He's obviously still in there, still has a chance, long way to go before the first votes. But when we look at 2012, everybody seemed to get their chance, but you really didn't see anybody rise back up once they had been pretty high up and then fell back. So he still has a chance to do that, but it's going to be a tough road.
And as you noted, Greg, this is a guy whose brand identity was he doesn't back down. So flip-flopping may be a little more dangerous to him than it is to the ordinary candidate.
Oh, Jim, on that note, we'll just pretend today never happened.
And I was going to say, America, if you want to go back to bed and start over tomorrow, we'll completely understand.
Absolutely. And hopefully Skype will be back from its worldwide shutdown tomorrow as well. Jim, talk to you tomorrow. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.